west, because even though I only had a little bit behind me here in the Bay Area. And it worked very, very well. I mean, it heard everything. And but that's under perfect conditions, and you got stuff coming from you in all different directions. So it's definitely a good little antenna. It'd be good enough, I think, for you to give it a try and see how well it works for you. So back to that, AB6MB.
Okay, thank you very much once again, Jeff. I believe I heard Frank also on EchoLink try to connect. So we'll leave the radio quiet for a second or two and give WB2BXO Frank a chance to get on.
Yeah, I feel like I'm trying to get into DX contest pileup here. Yeah, I operated, let me make sure, first of all, you copied me okay before I start to monologue here.
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Okay, very good. Yeah, EchoLink on this end at least has quite a bit of a latency, as you know. I operated, my dad and I operated a ground-mounted vertical with either one or two ground rods, probably one, and I do not remember how long it was, in Canarsie, up on Avenue M, a few blocks from the Canarsie Pier, since you probably, I know some of the guys on the net probably know the area. And I'll tell you, the only band that worked effectively on it was an 1880TWB high-gain antenna, so-called high-gain. That was the brand name anyway that did not really describe the antenna. The only band that worked very effectively on was 40 meters. I worked the world on 40 meters at a time when 40 meters was still filled with broadcasters, at least in the phone end of the band, so it was mostly the CW. In the 70s, 80s, and 90s. It did not function effectively on 20 meters and up. I really needed dipoles on those bands. And anyway, they were just like Rich, I think it was. Had a lot of issues with keeping the neighbors happy. Anyway, and I later read that the characteristics I was observing, excellent performance on 40 meters and poor performance above 10 megahertz is apparently well known. I saw that in a long article on a Usenet news group, I guess around 2001 or 2002. Apparently because of the physics of the way a vertical works, it does not function well at ground level above 40 meters. So for those who want to work 10 meters, keep that in mind. Apparently, you need to get a 10-meter vertical up in the air, maybe use one of these CB ground planes, and cut it a bit for 10 meters. Anyway, that was my experience. 80 meters, it had a top hat, which eventually fell off. It did not work very well. At least not to my standards on 80 meters. Go ahead, Roy. WB2BX.
Okay. Thanks, Frank. I haven't really read what you just said. Now, obviously, if you improperly set up radials on a vertical, yeah, you're going to get a lot of ground coupling, and that's going to affect different bands in different ways. But I think if you properly, put a bunch of radials out, you know, 36 or more, I think you could use them for 10 meters and 20 meters. The takeoff angle should be reasonably good for skywave propagation. So this is the first I heard that basically ground verticals kind of run out of steam at 40 meters. I think it has to do more with how you approach the radial system.
W2BC?
Yes, Rich? Yes, Rich?
I saw a very interesting YouTube with a guy who put up a vertical, just a wire, you know, I forgot how long the wire was, but as a counterpoise or as radios, what he did was he sunk a 9-foot section of ground braid into the water. He was at a dock, and he worked. That antenna worked fine, except for 10 meters. He said 10 meters was impossible to raise a signal. So that sort of concurs with, I forget the name of the gentleman who just spoke, but that concurs with that. It worked great on 40 and good on 20 and not, worse on 15 and not on 10 at all. So there may be something to that, Roy.
Okay. Well, I mean, not really working well with 10 versus not working past 40 to me is a little bit different. And putting it in seawater is also to me a little bit different. But I don't know. I'm sure there's loads of people out there that have used ground-based vertical antennas. And, you know, if you want to put in your own 2 cents of your experiences, please feel free. Yes, Wesley?
Partial answer to that is covered in one of the topics that I would like to discuss when my time comes up. That is the effing system resistance and impedance of Earth.
Okay, when we get to it, I just want to clear the way for the amateur radio, the total complete amateur radio people before we kind of go into the more eclectic. I hope you don't mind. You know, I thought we agreed to that.
No, I don't mind. Just, I'm just saying that might be helpful.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I have a R7 vertical, and it is ground-mounted. It's only up about maybe 10 feet where the base of it is. And I've worked the world on 20, 15, and I've used it on 10 meters. It loads up fine, no problem.
Okay. I think it's one of those cases of your mileage might vary. You know, some people find some things that have no theoretical value work great for them, and others that everyone says is a great antenna, and you take it out and you put it up, and you get absolutely nothing from it. So all these antenna stories should go with a little warning label. Your mileage might vary.
WR2U with a comment about ground.
Yes, please. Feel free.
Yeah, okay, Roy, very good. Yeah, I think the gentleman might be correct about certain types of soil conditions having dramatically increased loss resistance and a very different index of refraction at frequencies above like 25 megahertz, where ground losses can soar, actually. So I'm not sure about seawater. Seawater is pretty darn conductive no matter what frequency you're at. But if you take a look at typical soil like we have here, sandy conditions mostly with a little bit of mineral content and very little water, I think you're going to find out that if you go through it, the ground losses above 25 megahertz are quite a bit higher than they would be at 7 megahertz. That might be what he's talking about. So, of course, mounting an antenna close to ground with radials that are tightly coupled to ground would give poorer performance than if you raise the antenna a couple of feet above. So I think he's correct, but that's not exactly a physical statement that I could say about all types of soil. It's just about the nature of the kind of soil that we have around here, I believe. Back to Net, WR2U.
Yes, Wesley recognized. Just want to add my 2 cents worth. Okay, that I could understand, but I still think that if you pile up the radials sufficient to shield against a degree of ground coupling, you might be able to mitigate some of that, so that if you have something like 40 radials surrounding the base, you have less of a chance having problems, say, at 10 meters than if you just had 6 or 8 of them. So, you know, ultimately I could understand the basis for that, but I don't think it's a fundamental binary yes-no type of thing. It depends, as you mentioned, on the quality of the soil and I think as well on the amount of radials that you employ to block some of the ground coupling.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree. You're tending to copper plate your backyard, sure. If you extend the number of copper radials, the more and longer the better. Eventually what happens is copper dominates and soil losses do not, and you would increase the antenna system efficiency tremendously. Now, I was kind of talking about the typical ground plane type of antenna with 3, maybe 4 radials, and that's it. You're talking about a very elaborate ground system, and, of course, all bets are off there. The ground system performance will dominate, and soil conditions aren't so much of a factor. Back to Ned.
Okay, very good. So basically, we agree. You added some fine details, which I appreciate, that the ground loss is affected differently with different frequencies. Almost every literature that I've ever read about ground-based verticals implore people to not go under something like 36 radials when it's smack dab on the ground. So putting a ground-based legitimate quarter-wave vertical with 3 radials is sort of asking for not the greatest efficiency of an antenna.
From the radio for a minute. Yes, I agree 100%. And that's pretty much the antenna that I was talking about, a conventional type of a ground plane. Anybody who has the ability to lay down a number of low-loss radials of various at long dimensions, if they possibly could, laying on top of the ground or perhaps buried just below it so you can still mow your lawn perhaps, I think that kind of a system would be a tremendous advantage, but not of course everybody can do that way.
That's true. Yeah, it depends on how anal retentive and how much money and how much time you have. Some people think that they're very clever. They'll put down chicken wire. And as you know and I know and a whole bunch of people out there know, that's not a good idea. Once those pieces of metal get corroded, you have 100 or 1,000 nonlinear devices that are going to wreak havoc with your RF. But I've read a lot of stories of guys who say, aha, you know, they can't afford to have a sheet of copper on their lawn, but they do try the chicken wire occasionally.
They have an infinite supply of mixers that whose local oscillators are driven by the high power output of the transmitter. And whatever mixed product signals are available, well, someplace or another, the intermods are going to show up on some frequency. So good luck with that.
Yes, it's a recipe for a mess, but again, it has been known to happen. Sometimes people will put 2 and 2 together and unfortunately come up with 22.
Now, not to be recommended. All right, I'll let you go. I got a couple of errands to run here, but very good net tonight. WIT, you're clear.
Thank you. Wesley, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, the electric impedance, the antenna and cutter should be seen from the perspective of impedance. So electric impedance of aqueous, I don't know how to probably pronounce it, KCL and NACL solution salt concentration dependence on the components of equivalent of electric circuit. So if we go a little bit deeper, but not much deep to it, then we could say that conductivity is directly proportional to salinity. That is, when salinity increases, the conductivity will also increase. It's a simple system. but going deeper into it, we should say a few words about the impedance of the earth. But that's when my time comes. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Wesley. Anyone with any further comments before we move on from this subject?
And to only one?
Yes. Yes, I think it was N2ODY.
Yeah, close. N2LDY, November 2, Lima Delta Yankee. I've been listening to you guys about the antennas, and I found it very interesting. I just had a question, and, you know, since there's a lot of minds out here, about lightning arrestors, if somebody maybe could, you know, steer me in the right direction. I have actually two long NFED antennas here at the house. One's longer than the other, and I've been trying to decide whether or not to install lightning arrestors. I'm not sure who gets them.
Okay, your name is Donald?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, QSL.
Okay, Donald. They are readily available. Most of them are made for coaxial transmission line. There are open wire versions of lightning dissipators. Basically, it's just a glorified neon bulb set to ground. They Alpha Delta sells them. There's a whole bunch of companies that sell them. It's kind of belt and suspenders, but sometimes it's good to make absolutely positively sure that your pants don't fall down. So it's not a very expensive product to buy. And just to have it inserted in your transmission line on the outside, don't let any of it get inside your house, and provide it a nice ground external to your shack rather than introducing it into your shack and plugging it into an outlet ground or a cold water pipe ground, because you don't want to invite lightning in.
Okay. One other question. So outside the house where my shack is, I have the rig grounded to a ground rod that's in the ground there. I'm curious, would I, or should I, maybe put a second ground rod separate from that to ground the lightning arrestor? Or would the same ground be sufficient?
Well, for most people, it should be sufficient. Again, there are a belt, suspenders, and staple gun people. When they put a ground rod down, they don't put a ground rod down. They put a number of ground rods down, and then they bond all the ground rods together. You know, some people might consider that excessive, others not. But you could get away reasonably safe by using the same ground rod for your lightning arrestor.
I appreciate your input. You know, I've been thinking about it, and I figured, you know, this would be the perfect opportunity to ask some questions about it. So I'm going to turn it back over to the net or whatever, and I'll be listening in here.
Okay, very good, Donald. Yes, this is the Limark Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. It's a regular thing for about 42 and a half years now. Okay, so hopefully everyone's kind of beaten this dead horse, and hopefully John NQ1U is still around. I guess I should call out to see if Wayne KD2UDU has gotten back on the radio. So, Wayne, are you out there, Wayne?
WS2N.
Paul recognized, Frank recognized. Let's give the push to talk a rest for a second. We'll hear from Frank, and we'll hear from you, Paul.
Yeah, okay, very good. No way I can claim that the high gain vertical was an optimal configuration. I tried a number of times. There was no way I was going to be allowed to run lay radios on or under the ground through the landlord's garden in Canarsie. Believe me, I had many long arguments about that because I absolutely had read and agreed that that would function better than the one ground rod that only seemed to function effectively on 40 meters. It may well have functioned well at higher frequencies with true ground. Anyway, that's all water under the bridge years ago. Another thing I observed, I think a mistake that most of us make, is that you really can't judge the performance of an antenna unless you compare it to something. I mean, on 10 meters at the peak of the sunspot cycle, you can work anything with almost no antenna, and that does not mean you're necessarily getting out well. I thought my antenna was doing reasonably well on the higher frequencies until I put up, more properly, my dad, I think with some help from the landlord, stretched out a 15-meter vertical and a 20-meter vertical out to the clothesline pole with a proper balance. And we found the performance was much, much better, even though I was at times heard on the vertical. My signal seemed to be about the equivalent of other stations running 5 watts when I was running over 100 watts. So unless you have something to compare it to, you cannot really tell, and my experience has been, how well your antenna is performing. I could go on and on about this, but I remember in the end, getting some amazing reports on 40 meters and nowhere else with the antenna. WB2BXO, I'll be back later this evening.
Okay, very good. I agree with you. People measure what they can measure. Back in the very old days, at best, all that they could do was tell you how many watts they were putting into the transmission line. Now they can tell you what their standing wave ratio is, and they stare at it reflectively many times a day. If people could actually measure their antenna efficiency, I think it would revolutionize the hobby and depress all of us, because most of us would get back readings that would just sadden us intensely. You know, a lot of people would get back the fact that their antenna is approximately 3% efficiency, and they would just fall into a depression. So it's probably, to a degree, a good thing, with my tongue firmly in my cheek, that we can tell the efficiency. And the only real, you could kind of get a sense for it by its performance, as you mentioned. But I mean, ultimately, you would have to put it in a big anechoic chamber and have a whole bunch of technicians walk around with signal strength meters and write it down and then plot it on a 3D computer simulation and such. And lots of luck that happening anytime soon. But I agree with you. We have no appreciation for the efficiency of our antenna, and that's probably in the short term a good thing.
I don't think you need to do what Dick did with the antennas on the B-1B bomber and put the thing with all its antennas in a huge anechoic chamber and measure the antenna performance. I think what you're describing is what Dick did with the B-1B bombers, if I remember the description correctly. At least that's what he was able to tell us in the unclassified world. I don't think you need to do anything that sophisticated. Just compare your antenna performance with a ham in your local area, if you can, and round robin contact that is not so much with somebody. I don't mean in making local contacts, because that's, especially on 10 meters, that's, you get, you know, differences in polarization and stuff. But, say, working at least one hop E-layer, F-layer propagation and see how your signals compares. And you might, and you are probably going to be shocked in one direction or other with the results. Go ahead, Roy. WB2BX.
Well, I certainly agree with you, Frank. It's not cost-effective. For those those bombers and for a lot of military where they have the money and they have the facilities and they really want to know exactly how efficient their antenna systems are, it serves their purposes. It would bankrupt all of us. The problem that I have with your description, it's good. You know, I mean, it's certainly an inexpensive version of getting something. But it's a comparison to another relative unknown. You know, if you compare your system to that neighbor and it's somewhat equivalent, maybe it's 10% less, you don't know how efficient that guy is. That guy could have a 5% efficiency antenna. So now you have a 4% efficiency antenna, and you're thrilled with it because it's close to the other guy's. So the problem with that, unfortunately, would be that you're comparing it against an unknown value. So you know if it's more or less than the unknown value, but you still don't know the initial unknown value.
Yeah, ideally, what you want to do is compare to your own antenna. Eventually was able to put up a couple of dipoles and compare them to the performance of the vertical at the higher frequencies and see that the dipoles performed much better. That's a little better way to do it, is to put up a couple of different antennas if you have the opportunity to do that. But go ahead.
Okay. Again, unfortunately, since there's no standard, you know, it's sort of like testing it using a volt-ohmmeter that's never been calibrated. So if you use that as a means for a bunch of measurements, you tend to know the approximate relative degree. But the absolute degree is unknown because you don't have a standard or anything. But, you know, I understand that it's just impractical to really have a definitive efficiency calculation done on any antenna. You don't even see antenna manufacturers that have more money than we do offer it up, plus the fact that if they did it legitimately and gave you the numbers, it would probably depress their sales.
Yeah, well, I think the ARRL still does not allow claims of antenna gain in QST because they think they're all full of baloney. Go ahead.
Yes, that is my understanding as well. I think I've heard more than one time someone from ARRL suggest that those numbers do not come out of engineering, they come out of marketing. And I can kind of believe it. And again, the problem with human beings is we don't really appreciate what the numbers really mean. You know, people go crazy if their SWR isn't 1.0. If it's 1.1, they have to twitch and twirl and dial and correct. And the amount of loss introduced by a 1.1-to-1 mismatch is infinitesimal. You know, the transmission line introduces a lot more loss. And the same thing with these other factors. You know, they just kind of exaggerate the importance of it.
Yeah, another thing Dick used to say was that antenna design is 100% scalable. And I think he sort of said the same thing. You know, he would build, say, I guess the way you're describing it is you can build an test an antenna design at 2.4 gigahertz because it's very small, and you can use an antenna range as large as your desk is the way Dick described it, and the same design is exactly scalable to HF, apparently, if you can build it mechanically, which you can't always do. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I remember him saying it, and as far as I'm aware, it isn't. It's true. All antennas follow the same exact laws of physics, be they microwave or be they very long frequency. The only thing that changes is the scale. The smaller it is, the lighter it is, the less mechanical constraints, the less material costs. It's far easier to build a Wi-Fi antenna than it is to build an 80-meter antenna. I mean, anyone who's ever had the two antennas knows extremely the difference. So, yeah, I would agree entirely. It's the mechanical disadvantages as you scale up the size because you're decreasing the frequency or you're increasing the wavelength. Either way, you can look at the same thing.
Okay, I think if you said, though, kind of beating a dead horse here, so I'll let you go on to the next thing. I have some things to do, but I'll be back in later this evening for the space report. Thanks a lot, Roy. WB2BX up.
Okay, very good. Let's move on to our next person, John NQ1U. Are you still with us, John?
This is NQ1U. Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. I'm not just hanging out. I'm learning stuff. Thank you. My question and topic, my topic is I'm interested in some digital things which I haven't been doing. And if there are comments about hotspots, I know this is probably a 7-day discussion, but if anybody wants to throw out some comments on recommended hotspots and types of hotspots, I'd appreciate it. This is NQ1U. Thanks.
Okay, that's a good question, and getting into the nitty-gritty of hotspots, yeah, you could spend a lot of time. Everyone kind of has their favorite. I am not a big fan of Raspberry Pi-based Pi-Star hotspots. I'm sure that's the overwhelming majority of people who have hotspots are using a Pi-Star. I like OpenSpot. I think it's RF Parts or something. I forget the name of the company, but they make the OpenSpot versions of hotspots. They started with just the OpenSpot, then the OpenSpot 2, and the OpenSpot 3, and I think they're now on to the OpenSpot 4. And this time of year is probably the only time they discount the OpenSpots. I don't know if they've already done it for Black Friday or they're going to do it soon, but this is around the time where you can get probably $20 off of it. It's more expensive than the Raspberry Pi-based Pi-Stars. They are proprietary. The user interface is, I find it, more sophisticated, more user-friendly. Some of the newer OpenSpots, the OpenSpot 4, one of the versions comes with a built-in battery, so you don't need to plug it into a power source. Where Pi-Stars, you pretty much have to. I'm sure there are some that have a lithium-ion battery strapped to it. Also, because of the newer, higher-end OpenSpot 4 Plus or something, it has two AMBI chips. The AMBI chips decode the digital stream. So by having one AMBI chip, you are kind of stuck. If you want to go to a fusion-based server on a hotspot, you have to use a fusion-based radio. If you want a D-Star, you need to do a D-Star radio. By having two AMBI chips or binary in one chip, you're able to transcode, so you can take a handy-talkie set up for fusion and talk to a DMR or talk to a D-Star server on a hotspot. So that's just the surface. If there's anything that piqued your curiosity and you want more knowledge about it, let me know.
No, I think the versatility of that sounds good. I was looking at that. Yeah, 4, I think, is the current version. And I'm thinking seriously of that. So if that's the comment, that's great. If anybody else wants to say something, I appreciate it. But thank you very much.
You're welcome, John. If anyone else has any other favorites, like I said, most people tend to buy Pi-Stars. Different people, as far as I'm aware, there's not a major company that just kind of pumps them out endlessly. So there's a lot of different manufacturers that have their variation. The place that I bought my Anytone radio recently got into the business, and they set up their own little Pi-Star version hotspot. There's a lot on eBay. There's a lot on Chinese, sales, retail sales. You know, if you want to take a risk, you get it at low price. I have a perennial problem with Raspberry Pi. I like Raspberry Pis, but inevitably their SD card does get corrupted. There's something inherently problematic where a Raspberry Pi once in a great while will read garbage into your SD card and ruin it. So, you know, if you do get a Pi-Star type of a hotspot, be prepared to know how to reflash the SD card, because if you use it long enough, you will need to reflash it. But again, if anyone has any other opinions other than mine, feel free to share. Okay, didn't hear any voice there. Someone just keyed the repeater, and I heard a little background noise from his room. So I'll give it one more last try, and then move on.
KD2, UWR, with a question.
Yes, Mike.
Yes, it's a separate topic. Is it okay to go now, or you want to wrap up the last one?
Well, I assume it's going to be relatively short. I think we wrapped up the last one. No one really had any other response about hotspots. So you might as well let it rip.
Okay. Thank you, Roy. This is Mike, KD2UWR. I have a question regarding APRS. Right now I have a Bluetooth TNC to a Baofeng UV5R through the speaker mic jack. It works when I'm near I-8s and digipeaters, but I'm wondering if the low-cost, low-quality radio is limiting my performance. And my question is, given, you know, APRS is packet-based and there's no handshaking, I know you have to have a good signal. My question is, what parameters are most important when looking and shopping around for a better HD, specifically for APRS packet data transmit and receive performance? Which key parameters would I look at first?
Okay, that's a good question. I don't really have personally that much experience with APRS. I've seen it used. I have it on some of my machines. And I certainly hope that some of more astute listeners will participate and help me out on this. I would think that as long as you have a decent bandwidth, one of the problems I see with Baofengs is that sometimes they come out of the factory with very narrow frequency range. Their deviation is set to ultra narrow, and although I don't know for sure, I would assume that would impact to a degree on its ability to transfer APRS signals. So as long as it's a consistent, normal, narrow FM, that shouldn't be a problem. You might benefit from a slightly more powerful power output module. You know, some handy talkies can put out 7 watts instead of 5 watts. Occasionally, sometimes those are highly theoretical and not in the real world. But as far as I'm aware, those are the only two things I would be concerned about when it came to handy talkie selection for APRS. I would be incredibly interested if there's anyone who knows this subject better than I, if they could add their expertise to this question. So if you're out there and you have an opinion, please feel free. Okay, Mike, apparently no one has any other opinion. So that's as far as I'm aware. I don't think intermod distortion is going to be a big major problem. I don't think selectivity and sensitivity is going to affect your ability to operate APRS. So as far as I'm aware, it's simply the deviation that it's set for and the power output that will kind of determine how well you'll be able to pass on those APRS packets.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. I'll continue to do more reading on it, but I figured I'd throw it out to TestNet. Thank you, Roy.
Sure, and if you find out something differing what I said, feel free, come back, tell us. We all want to be educated.
WS2N.
Ah, yes, Paul, I'm so terribly sorry. I was going to get back to you ages ago, and I totally, utterly forgot. Forgive me, Paul.
No. I get involved listening to the topics. They're pretty good, and I'm on plenty at night later on. Jeff was on from California, and he was talking about the Starlink antenna. But look, he's probably gone by now, although maybe he's listening. Anyway, he was looking for the type of antenna, you know, the little antennas that are inside that Starlink. There's like 1,200 or over 1,200 little antennas, but they're patch antennas. That's probably what he was looking for.
Oh, okay. I thought he was just searching for beamforming. He's left EchoLink by now, by the way.
Okay, yeah, well, yeah, they have beamforming systems. Yeah, as each little antenna, patch antenna is, they change the phase on each one. You could change the beam of where the main globe is going out, and by having it not only in one direction, but a big dish, you have three different, you have a two different directions, so you know, I think they're set up for around 100 degrees, so you can go from 100 degrees, east, west, north, or south, just by changing the phase for all those little antennas. But, all right, very good. I thought he was looking for the patch name, because that's what they are. Each little one is controlled by tiny little chips, and then that's all tied into software. The software knows where the antennas are, because you put in you also have a GPS attached to your Starlink antenna, so it knows where you are, and basically that's how it works. But I don't know, maybe he'll be back. He's usually back every week. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, he should be coming back. He usually is here for first hour or so. Yeah, patch antenna is very interesting. Primarily, you will see them in microwave technologies, and they don't really look terribly impressive, but they are. They just look like little metallic rectangles, but they get the job done. So thanks for adding that, Paul, tonight. Let's get to you, Wesley. I'm sorry that we delayed it, but I just wanted to clear the decks of amateur radio stuff in case we go into a wee bit of blue sky stuff. So take it away, Wesley.
Thank you very much. I'm going to be trying rather quickly go through all of the subjects. So infinitely straight coil. So if you're looking at a piece of wire lying on the table, it has the elements of the impedance, which is the capacitance, the inductance, even if it's straight, and resistance. And if we look at it, you might think, hey, the circuit breaker, like the one in the glass, is a piece of wire. That can represent also infinitely straight, I mean, not infinity, but straight coil. And the question is, if you look at it sometime, you see that it blows up. It didn't burn, it blows up. It explodes. It bursts. So my question is, what is the reason for that infinitely straight coil or that piece of wire in the fuse to explode, not to burn? And to reach it.
Okay, I wouldn't confuse people by calling it an infinitely coiled wire, because it's not an infinitely coiled wire. What's happening, and it harkens back to a long time ago, one of my puzzles was what is inside a high current fuse that people don't naturally think of, and the answer was sand. And the reason was because if you don't put something that's a thermal conductor, like the sand works as, what happens is the metal becomes hot enough to vaporize. And that's what's going on there.
About a century ago, the Rutherford was writing to Mr. Kapitsa. And it was probably the first time when they mentioned about exploding coil, which could be a piece of wire. It's still a coil. And he said that we managed to obtain fields over 270,000 volts. And we could not go further. The color burst with the great bunk, with no doubt, would amuse you very much if you could hear it. So that element of a piece of wire blowing instead of being burned, getting hot, was something that puzzled scientists a century ago. And we go to the properties, possible properties of white blows, white bursts. Could you specify some of those properties?
Yes, its melting point. It reaches the temperature of the metal reaches beyond the point where it changes not only from solid to liquid, but liquid to partially gaseous. And it sprays vapor all over the place. And one of the other reasons why you use things like sand is it blocks the spewing of conductor in a conducting path. If you don't have something like the sand, what can happen is the metal can vaporize, and when it reaches the surface of the fuse, cool down, recrystallize, and if it recrystallizes in a straight line from one connector to the other connector, you have another conductor that's shorted out that's going to blow up again. So that's two reasons. So it's basically a function of the melting point and vaporization pressure of the thing that you use as a conductor.
Well, I have a problem with that, because then you need to explain why that is so accurate, 2.125 of an amp, point at which it blows. Actually, it burst. Energy. Hey, look at them.
Yes, Jeff.
Well, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about resistance heating, I'm sure, from a large passage of current, right, Roy? And I have a question, which is, perhaps parallel to that and reflective of something, no pun intended, reflective of the efficiency discussion you had previously. But I'll hold off on that question. But I just wanted you to confirm that it was power heating that you're talking about. Is that correct, Roy?
Yeah, fuses work on heat dissipation, and it disrupts the conductor. If the output is above normal, if the output current is way above normal, it doesn't really have a chance to thermally dissipate, and the whole glob of conductor can just kind of explode. So yeah, it's thermal resistance. Taken to the extreme of the particular material.
Okay. Rich, you see the coil, the 5-6 loop, that under the impulse of the current mechanically moves up.
You asking me a question, Wesley?
That is correct.
Well, I'm sure under a high enough current, where you're changing the temperature of the material, metals will expand as you heat them up, and they will move. Differing metals placed next to each other will curl as the heat goes up. So metals do change their expand and contract according to the temperature. I don't think it's the electrical current itself inherently that changes its expansion coefficient. It's just the thermal issue.
How about if I say you that physical reason for magnetic burst consists in strength the field possess, static electric and magnetic fields possess longitudinal strength and pressure of the same value, orthogonal to the lines of force, the pressure acts on the winding, which therefore holds it back unless the force of pressure overweights and then the coil bursts. So if we go further, then we could say that the correct description in real magnetic burst is possible only with the kind of certain various physical properties of the carrier of the electric current, and that would be particularly its firmness, because the mechanical decomposition of the winding is inevitably takes away a part of electromagnetic energy, and that has not much to do with the temperature. Enter G. Is it okay?
Yes, Jeff.
There is no winding. It's a linear piece of metal. I think you're thinking that there's actual impedance at 60 hertz that actually plays a role here, which it doesn't. I'm sure it's all IR heating.
Well, I have the problem with that either. At first, I asked the question to the void, did you see the coil with 5 winds to move mechanically under the current? And then, if you look at some of the fuses, you see the small coil in the fuse. It's just a microscale. Everything that is in megascale could be tested, or at least most of everything could be tested in microscale. Do you agree with that?
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John recognized. I just want to point out that there are some fuse designs that instead of having just a straight wire, will sometimes have a loosely coiled wire. I think those are usually slow burn fuses, but they do exist. John, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to say. The slow blow fuses, if you look at them, they have a little, like, spring element. I think Wesley's thinking that is some kind of inductance. That is just a little spring in there it has to do with the retarding of the fuse so that it can handle surges. It won't blow on a, like a motor starting surge or something like that. And again, that's only a spring element. It has nothing to do with any inductance or anything like that.
Well, I have the explanation that parts of conducting material polarize and produce their own fields and thereby interact with that burst, because it's a burst. It's not at the given point rapid meltdown at 2.125 of an amp. And otherwise, it was the magnetic flux tube that exploded. And to actually.
ACTPL, I retract my previous question, Roy, and QRT.
Okay, Jeff, maybe some other time. You're always welcome.
Two scientific papers, explosion of infinite straight solenoid, and those are from a scientific website. And to actually.
ACTPL, clearing QRT.
Okay, I unfortunately Wesley doubled with you. You're always welcome, Jeff. Here, you can ask me the question any other night. Okay.
Roger. Thank you, Roy, for what you do. Have a good night.
Okay. So we have disagreement in here, but it's okay. We take a side, and actually, we can. Turn for judgment to Dr. Roy and Tershi.
I am not quite sure what the question or the answer or what that was. I'm just kind of Googling your question, seeing what other people. Usually they don't discuss magnetic fields or impedance. The amount of impedance introduced by any coil in any fuse with a 60 hertz signal is kind of infinitesimal. So although you could set up experiments where the alternating current has a much higher frequency and the coils are more robust, in real life, as far as the setup that you presented of a coiled fuse and a 60 cycle AC current, I don't think that this situation that you're discussing is based upon those setups, but on something a wee bit more esoteric, perhaps?
I absolutely agree with you. So when we're talking about a fuse, you are completely right. It's mostly the temperature that is affecting the fuse. The only thing is that there is a certain range of the temperature that is affecting the fuse. So that would be also agreeing with the gentleman that decided to QRD. When we're talking about the explosion of infinite straight solenoid, then we're talking about unspecified length of the copper wire that is exploding instead of melting. And that's what you can look at if you Google it, explosion of infinite straight solenoid.
Oh, let me see if I have the repeater, by the way. Oh, okay, I have the repeater. AC2GS, if anyone's still wondering. I think one of the problems, Wesley, is when you threw out the fuse, you confused everyone because we kind of take it for granted that when you say a fuse, you mean a fuse. You don't really seem to mean a fuse. You what you mean is a theoretical construct that cannot exist in the real world. You cannot have infinite structures, and an infinite solenoid is an infinite structure, and by no way or means is it actually a fuse. So, you know, for just future reference, it would be best not to kind of confuse people by talking about things that are somewhat similar but not. So, again, you're not talking about a fuse. You're talking about a theoretical construct. That's a different thing entirely, and that's probably what's confusing us here.
In this paper that I have in front of me, I have a letter stating about the coil that was used in the device, and that coil blow up like a fuse at the certain conditions. And it was 100 years ago, and it was performed by Rutherford. Now, I agree with you. The only thing that I thought, and it was my mistake, that if I don't talk about the 60 or 50 hertz, but I talk about a certain frequency at which the coil, that coil